The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today I'll begin reading to you from the issue of Time Magazine, dated March 1/March 8, 2021. This is the one that says Time in white lettering upon the rosy pink background with a model, a female model, standing and wearing a floaty chiffon frock in hot pink on the cover. It says the next 100 most influential people. Actually, you'll be hearing a mere sampling of that after I read a few of the other opening articles to you. Time permitting, I will then refer to the previous edition of Time, dated February. Well, it's not actually the previous, but it's the one that I read previously to you, February 1 to February 8, 2021. I will not repeat any articles previously read, and that will be on a time-permitting basis. From the most recent edition of Time, then, I begin with an article entitled No Right Answers. How will officials decide if someone with asthma gets a vaccine before a cancer patient? This is by Alice Park. A lot of purple-topped vials, small vials of medication are photographed here. They have frosty tops. They contain a clear substance, and there appears to be a tray of them. The photograph is by Evan Jenkins for Time. The caption reads, vials of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine at a Chicago area Walgreens hub, January 6. They are, in fact, the little vials are, in fact, clearly labeled Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19. And then they have lot numbers and expiration dates on them. The caption of this article is Health. In an ideal world, there would be enough vaccine doses to inoculate everyone who wanted to get immunized against COVID-19. People would get their shots on a first-come, first-served basis. We would achieve herd immunity in a matter of months, and COVID-19 would soon become a distant memory. But with some 240 million people over age 16 who need a COVID-19 vaccine, and two doses at that for the first two manufacturers, Pfizer and Moderna. Just over 42 million administered by early February, supply is far below demand and will likely remain that way for months to come, despite vaccine makers pushing production lines as hard as they can. As the U.S. works through the vaccine priority groups and begins to shift into ever larger populations in coming months, the pace of doses shipped could continue to outstrip the pace of administration. So far, the shots have been reserved primarily for healthcare workers, people living in long-term care facilities, and those over 65. Some states have begun vaccinating essential workers like law enforcement officers, teachers, and those who work in mass transit. All of these groups are relatively easy to reach and vaccinate since they are well defined. But the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, guidelines, next big priority group, people with underlying health conditions that make them more vulnerable to COVID-19, is much less so. While many are connected to the healthcare system by virtue of their medical conditions, there's a substantial portion of these patients who are not seeing doctors or getting their medical problems addressed. There are also likely to be a lot of them. According to the CDC, up to 60% of adult Americans have chronic conditions, some of which put them at higher risk of developing COVID-19. And around 28.5 million Americans have no health insurance, making them less likely to have regular access to health care. The CDC lists 12 conditions, ranging from diabetes to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, heart and kidney diseases, cancer, and obesity, that put people at higher risk of getting COVID-19 or having complications if they do. And there are other conditions like asthma, hypertension, and many more for which data are still being gathered. But those conditions, too, might make people more vulnerable to COVID-19. Given that there continues to be a limited supply of doses, doctors and local health officials are bracing for gut-wrenching decisions about which patients to vaccinate first, with the potential nightmare scenario of cancer patients fighting with heart patients for scarce doses. Should someone with cancer undergoing chemotherapy get vaccinated before someone awaiting a liver transplant? Does someone with asthma have a higher risk of getting COVID-19 than someone with dementia? No one wants to be on the committee that makes these allocations, says Dr. Cameron Wolfe, associate professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine. Just over a decade ago, Wolfe was part of his hospital's committee that determined how to distribute scarce H1N1 vaccines during that outbreak, and he knows doctors and patients can make compelling arguments for nearly every patient. It is a problem for which there are no right answers. Daniela Levine Cava, mayor of Miami-Dade County in Florida, is concerned about how her health officials will make those distribution decisions when the time comes, and hopes for more guidance from either the federal or state government. The governor of Florida has opened up vaccination to people over age 65, including those with health conditions, and that's already caused confusion and anxiety among residents since there are not enough doses for this group. We have a lot of people desperate in that category and very worried, very anxious, she says. It will be complicated to determine eligibility. There are so many different categories. How do you determine and judge who is more at risk? I'm in favor of national uniformity. This is the kind of thing that cries out for predictability. The more predictability and clarity we can have, the better. State health departments, however, are inclined to stay out of such granular decisions for two reasons. First, there is no universal solution that works for everybody, and any strategy they might choose to use to triage patients for vaccines would leave some eligible people behind. Second, the more prescriptive states are about allocating vaccines, the longer the shots can take to get into people's arms, and the greater the chance that some are wasted as doctors try to parse the policies and spend precious time making sure they are complying with them. When we get to that population, our preference would be to have the decision made between the provider and the patient, says Dr. Jinlin Chan, Acting Deputy Secretary of Public Health Services for the Maryland Department of Health. That, Chan says, would ensure that doctors who have the most information about their individual patients would be able to broadly stratify people in terms of their COVID-19 risk. That risk boils down to two vulnerabilities. First, how much risk their patients have for getting infected in the first place, which takes into account where they live and the infection rates there, and their exposure to high-risk settings, such as hospitals or public venues. And second, their risk for getting severely ill and potentially dying from COVID-19 if they were to be infected. Doctors will increasingly be faced with balancing these risks, and for them, the simplest strategies might be the most efficient. Wolf says a starting point to avoid the ethical and medical tangle of comparing people with different conditions might be to use age as the determining factor. Older people tend to have more health issues, and when they do, their conditions are generally more severe than those experienced by younger people. And that is especially the case with COVID-19, which hits elderly people harder. If I cannot medically stand in front of two patients and separate their arguments, how do I break the tie in cases where there's a scarce resource, he says. Sometimes age is the easy delineator. If someone's hypertensive with a BMI of 30, but only 25, their risk is less than someone who's hypertensive with a BMI of 30, but age 64. And if age is not a tiebreaker, practicality may rule the day. Whoever's available and can be vaccinated sooner should get the shot. But that layers the sticky question of access on top of sensitive triage issues. So far, doses have been funneled to hospitals, clinics, and other healthcare centers in order to reach the first priority group of healthcare workers. Yet around 25% of the U.S. population does not see a doctor regularly, according to a 2020 JAMA internal medicine study, much less have access to a hospital or clinic. As a result, many of these people have chronic conditions that are not treated at all, or if they are not well controlled. Reaching this group of people and making them comfortable with getting vaccinated is a black box that public health officials have not quite decoded yet. For now, hospitals and health systems are focusing on the lowest hanging fruit, their own patients. At least they have electronic medical records for these people and can contact them to let them know when they might become eligible for vaccination. Plus, if necessary, they can mine their health records to triage them by COVID-19 risk and therefore vaccination priority. Between two patients with diabetes, for example, they can determine who has less controlled blood sugar levels and place that person higher on the list than someone whose disease is better managed. At UCLA Health, this system generates an invitation list based on a risk score that weaves in not just the patient's medical condition, but also data from social determinants as well, such as poverty, income, education, housing, and geographic residence. These are part of the CDC's Social Vulnerability Index, created to identify medically vulnerable people and target health resources to them after natural disasters, such as hurricanes and infectious disease outbreaks like COVID-19. The index includes census data on 15 factors that help stratify people's overall health risk by acknowledging that some contributors to their health status have to do not with their medical condition, but rather with their living conditions, which in turn drive their access or lack thereof to health services. To identify our most vulnerable patients, we have an elaborate point system that incorporates age, clinical, and social risk data from the medical record to risk stratify our patients, says Dr. Eve Glazier, president of the faculty practice group at UCLA Health and an associate clinical professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. The formula weighs factors such as age and, say, whether a cancer patient's in remission or currently undergoing chemotherapy. Glazier says that in their health system, there are 120,000 patients over age 65 with chronic health conditions who are being prioritized over those over age 65 without health issues. We are really trying to avoid the Ticketmaster free-for-all approach, she says. The first-come, first-served strategy is antithetical to any approach that we would consider as fair and equitable. At Orlando Health, a private health system in Central Florida, officials formed a committee to come up with broad guidelines for helping doctors navigate the difficult decisions they might have to make as demand for vaccine doses continues to outstrip supply. We recently received 2,000 doses for medically vulnerable patients we are serving here, says Dr. George Rawls, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Orlando Health. We have 400,000 people over 65 in our network who qualify for vaccination, so 2,000 doesn't go very far. We are trying to find the riskiest patients and trying to give them the vaccine first. The system starts with age. We fine-tuned it to pull people out who we thought were at higher risk, starting with age as the main differentiator, Rawls says. We stratified the group of people aged 65 to 70, pulled up patients with certain diseases, and then looked at people aged 60 to 65 and worked through it like that. Patients with chronic conditions who are not able to get vaccinated if there are not enough doses in one round of vaccinations will be next in line and notified when more vaccines are shipped. It is going to go like that for a while, he says, as we continue to get small allocations as we continue to get small allocations of vaccine, we will apply them the best we can to patients who fit the highest risk profile. Now, before I return to the text, here's a small graph inset. Numbers are approximate sources. U.S. CDC and U.S. Census Bureau provided them. And it says, shooting for a higher number, 10% share of Americans who have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, 15% share of Americans over the age of 65 living in the U.S., 60% share of Americans with chronic health conditions, 28.5 million number of Americans without health insurance. Returning to the text, what is becoming clear is that highest risk will not mean the same from hospital to hospital or county to county or state to state, and that can lead to misunderstanding and frustration as people with the same health condition living in the same part of the country might not be able to get their shots at the same time. UCLA health officials are trying to head off any potential conflict by sending regular emails to their patient population outlining the system's triaging plan, how they came up with it, and which people are getting vaccinated at any given time. Still, some patients, desperate for a shot, are opting to game the system and find a hospital, even if it is not the one at which they are being treated, or state-run vaccination clinic that might get them vaccinated sooner. And that's fine, say most doctors and public health officials, who are at this point focused more on ensuring that as many people get their shots as quickly as possible than on establishing and policing complex priority policies. We are encouraging our patients to get the vaccine where they can get it first, says Glazier of UCLA. Los Angeles County is not using a risk stratification at their mega vaccination sites, and we're very candid about the model we're using, given the amount of doses we have. If they can get vaccinated at Dodger Stadium, then we encourage them to do that. Glazier says the UCLA system will record that vaccination in the patient's health record and drop them from future COVID-19 vaccine invitation lists. The challenge experts are worried about is figuring out how to help people with chronic health conditions who are not linked to a network like UCLA, Duke, Orlando Health, or others around the country without further burdening the rollout. Not only are they harder to reach, but it will be harder for vaccinators to validate that they qualify for a shot. It is not likely that states will require letters from doctors or other verification of their condition, since that would add a layer of bureaucracy that would further slow the push of vaccines into people's arms. Anytime you have to prove something, that gets awkward at the point of service, says Rawls. I do not know how that's going to play out and have not heard anything about a plan for public distribution, other than people saying they have a medical condition. That's a hurdle pharmacies, which are expecting to be the next large dispenser of vaccines to the public, will soon have to face as more people with these conditions turn to their local pharmacies for shots. In Maryland, Chan says the state is working with community leaders to reach more people who are not connected to a doctor or health system, regardless of whether they have an underlying health condition, to make sure more residents get vaccinated. They're currently jumping off their existing vaccination data to figure out where people are not getting vaccinated, and to the extent possible, determine how many people with existing health conditions might live in those areas, so officials can start directing more doses there. You cannot look at somebody and know whether they have an underlying condition or not, Chan says. So we're working with community organizations, and they're giving us feedback about the degree of outreach we will need and how we can almost walk the community to actually identify and find those individuals. Such efforts will take extra effort and resources, but are an integral part of the vaccine rollout, which to date has not been the focus of the COVID-19 vaccine campaign. We are trying to play catch-up because most of our efforts so far in COVID-19 have focused on making vaccines and testing them, and not so much on delivery, says Dr. Daniel Hoft, director of the St. Louis University Center for Vaccine Development. Thinking more deeply about the mechanics of the rollout will be crucial to making sure that members of the next priority group stepping up to be vaccinated get their shots when they need them, where they need them. The crisis around the corner, there's a photo here of two individuals who are wearing masks. They both look young, as nearly as I can tell, behind their masks. Both have red hair, a young woman and a man with a very long red beard. They're both wearing black. They're both standing in front of a structure, probably a house, because it looks like it has a two-car garage with an upstairs. Caption reads, "Millions of tenants are behind on rent. Mom and pop landlords are struggling. And a looming wave of evictions will make everything worse." This is by Abby Vesulis, Seattle. And the photographs by Jovel Tamayo for Time, under the headline Nation. In late November, Ryan DeLotte reached the end of her rope. Over the past year, her mom had received a cancer diagnosis, her dad had undergone major surgery, and DeLotte, 44, had been laid off from her job at a biotech startup. But her chief concern was the fact that she was now responsible for the mortgage, not only on her own home, a quaint one-story bungalow just south of Seattle's Ballard neighborhood, but also on an investment property, an unassuming two-bedroom condo 8 miles north in Shoreline. Her tenant, Ollie Aldama, had lost his job at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic in mid-March, began struggling to make his utility payments, and ultimately stopped paying monthly rent of $1,800. By Thanksgiving, he owed a lot more than $20,000. State and national eviction moratoriums prevented DeLotte from kicking Aldama out amid the COVID-19 pandemic, Yet her own financial situation was not flush enough to float him indefinitely. After months of anxiety, she decided to use a loophole in the law. She could force him out by moving into her rental condo herself. But when it came time to deliver the final notice of eviction, November 30, Dalat, who's previously faced housing insecurity, broke down. Dalat had become friends with Aldama, who'd been the bar manager at a local goth club where she was a regular. She knew if she evicted him, he and his partner, who's laid up with bad hips, would have nowhere to go. He teared up and I teared up. Dalat recalls, I could not do it. I just couldn't, in the middle of a pandemic, evict them. Landlords and tenants across the country are navigating similar situations. As COVID-19 shuttered bars and restaurants and devastated the blue-collar job market, millions of Americans watch their financial security vanish. While the unemployment rate has leveled off in recent months, more than a third of U.S. adults are still struggling to pay basic household expenses, according to a January Census Bureau survey, and 11% reported that their households did not get enough to eat the prior week. Nearly 12 million U.S. renters were expected to owe an average of almost $6,000 in late rent and utility payments per household by January, according to a December analysis by the economic research firm Moody's Analytics. So far, many of those tenants have gotten a reprieve. Several cities, like Seattle, and states including Washington, have made it temporarily illegal for landlords to evict most tenants for non-payment during the pandemic. In September 2020, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention strengthened these protections by issuing a federal ban on most evictions through January, which President Joe Biden extended through March 31. But these short-term fixes leave open the question of what happens when the eviction moratoriums expire in the coming months. Housing advocates predict both a tsunami of evictions and a significant rise in homelessness. If we do not find a way to keep people in their homes, it's going to be overload, says Janice Hardy, Regional Director of Family and Related Services for the YWCA, serving Seattle and King and Snohomish counties. There's not enough shelters to go around. On social media, the looming eviction crisis is almost rendered in Dickensian caricature. Greedy, fat cat landlords pushing vulnerable tenants into the street amidst the worst health crisis in a century, while activists demand that the government cancel rent entirely. The reality, as the case of Aldama and Dalat shows, is more complicated. More than 70% of properties with four or fewer rental units are not owned by fat cats at all, according to the National Association of Realtors, but rather people like Dalat, mom-and-pop landlords who often live nearby, manage the property themselves, rely on the rental income to pay their own mortgages, health care bills, and monthly expenses. Almost half the nearly 49 million rental units in the U.S. are owned by individuals who tend to offer more affordable housing in their communities than the billion-dollar conglomerates that build high-rises with marble counters and rooftop pools. These small landlords are shouldering a huge burden during the pandemic. For many, it's increasingly untenable. Dalat, who has since found a good new job working in gene therapy for a pharmaceutical company, is on better financial footing now. She remains morally opposed to putting people out if they cannot pay, especially under these circumstances, she says, but notes that every bit of the extra income she's making goes toward paying for Aldama's housing. It is not sustainable, she says, but I also do not see a means for them ever to be able to work on paying stuff back. Ollie Aldama's story may sound painfully familiar to millions of working-class Americans. After suffering a severe bout of necrotizing pancreatitis in 2014, that left him in a 3-month coma, he struggled to get back on his feet, plagued by a rare condition that causes his bones to grow where they should not. His knees, basically fossilized, preclude him from taking a trade job, and his weakened immune system makes in-person roles particularly dangerous amid a pandemic. While he was once a phlebotomist, his health certifications have long expired. Before COVID-19, Aldama took home about $35,000 a year on average. Now he's bringing in about a third of that, delivering takeout through DoorDash and Postmates. "I don't really ever buy new things," says Aldama, 40, noting that everything that he's wearing except his socks and underwear is used. "But no amount of thriftiness is enough to take him out of the red now," he adds, puffing on a half dozen cigarettes over the course of an hour-long interview. "There's never been a point in my adult life," he says, "where I ever thought I would be a hair's width away from living on the street." While COVID-19 has impacted most all Americans in some way, those with the lowest incomes have been the hardest hit, both by the virus and by the financial crisis it precipitated. According to an analysis by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, financially vulnerable counties, as measured through delinquency patterns on debts like credit card bills and car loans, saw higher ratios of COVID-19 infections and deaths than counties with lower delinquency rates. As of mid-July, the high delinquency counties saw an average of 4.3 cases per 1,000, while other counties saw 2.8 cases out of 1,000, according to the report. Likewise, while 14% of upper-income earners reported in August that they or someone in their household had lost their job or wages as a result of the pandemic, the share of low-income people in that position was 33%, according to the Pew Research Center. People of color have had it even worse. Black individuals as a whole are nearly twice as likely as non-Hispanic white individuals to die from a COVID-19 infection. And black and Hispanic people are more likely than white people, by margins of 5 and 9 percentage points respectively, to have lost their jobs at the outset of the pandemic, according to a Washington Post Ipsos poll. Stephen Musa, 29, embodies these racial disparities. After a welding job he'd been promised in Seattle disappeared in October, he fell more than $4,000 behind on rent and has since struggled to provide for himself and his 5-month-old son. His dream job is opening and running a food truck that serves West African soul food, but right now just getting by is tough. "Everything you hear is that the rest of the world is trying to go to the U.S. to get a better future," says Musa, who immigrated as a teenager from Liberia. "But you come here and you see that it is not that easy." Musa's grateful to the YWCA, a nonprofit that works to eliminate racism, empower women, and advance equity, for working with his rental property company to forgive his back rent. "But settling that debt is just the beginning," he says. Despite applying for at least a dozen jobs, he's yet to secure a consistent source of income and worries about keeping a roof over his family's head when the eviction moratoriums end this spring. "The management of the apartment complex has been sympathetic so far," he says, "but that hospitality is unlikely to last forever. The people that own these buildings have to pay their mortgages," he says. "They have to make money." Racial inequities in housing, a legacy in part of decades of racist mortgage and zoning laws, are visible in the eviction threat. Black people account for 13% of the U.S. population, but black renters like Musa make up 35% of the evictions carried out since March, despite the moratoriums, according to Princeton's Eviction Lab. The risk is especially high for black women, who collectively have faced 25% more evictions than black men since most state and local moratoriums took effect last spring and summer. Meanwhile, roughly 75% of landlords across the U.S. are white, according to a survey by Foremost Insurance Group. The share of white landlords is even higher in Seattle, per the city auditor. This creates an uncomfortable dynamic, says Edmund Witter, the managing attorney of the King County Bar Association's Housing Justice Project, which provides free legal aid to renters facing eviction. When one racial group is dependent on the other for a basic need, he says, there's something that feels inherently wrong about that. Muse's rental complex is owned by a trust that lists an all-white senior leadership team on its website. The federal government has yet to address the looming eviction crisis with a viable long-term plan. In December, Congress allocated $25 billion in emergency rental assistance, which state and local governments can use to reimburse landlords whose tenants have not paid rent. This comes after some local governments received block grants from the CARES Act to stave off evictions. But neither contribution is likely to be enough, says Mark Ellerbrook, the Division Director of Housing and Community Development for King County, home to Seattle. In an effort to ensure the federal money is distributed equitably, local governments have imposed a patchwork of stipulations. For example, 78% of emergency rental assistance programs require that landlords not evict their non-rent-paying tenants, with 10% of those programs requiring an agreement not to evict for a period of 7 months or longer, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, NLIHC. Other areas require landlords to freeze rent. In King County, tenants must earn 50% or less of the area's median income, and landlords must agree to accept 80% of the rent they're owed to be eligible. Delotte, who is considering applying for the funds, notes that even if she received the aid, she would not be made whole, since Aldama now owes more than the county's reimbursement cap, which is around $20,000. Another problem is that most local governments facing their own budget crises lack the staff to distribute the cash in a timely manner. Instead, some counties are leaning on nonprofits, many of which are also understaffed and underfunded, to manage the new program. Meanwhile, in pricey areas like Seattle, plenty of tenants make more than the local median income, yet still cannot afford their rent, Ellerbrook points out. And some landlords may be put off by the bureaucratic hurdles of applying for aid, a reality that may drive mom-and-pop landlords out of the rental market, leading to a long-term decrease in affordable rental housing in communities where it's already scarce. Like Delotte, Aldama knows the current arrangement is unsustainable in the long run, and neither of them sees an easy way out. Aldama will continue to do food deliveries as long as his clunker of a car starts, and he plans to apply for more in-person jobs after he's vaccinated. But for now, the possibility of making enough to pay his rent next month, much less his back rent, would be laughable if it were not so scary. When I set out to leave his condo, he suggests I stop by a homeless encampment down the road. There's probably 150 people living there, Aldama says, of the intersection of Lake City Way and Northeast 125th Street. Looking closely, he adds, he may join them soon. This is with reporting by Mariah Espada, Washington, and that article was abridged. I'll now read a sampling of Time's lengthy coverage of 100 current influential people. Chloe Zhao, 38, visionary filmmaker, by Frances McDormand, who's an Oscar-winning actor and a producer. When navigating the many unknowns of low-budget, improvisational, guerrilla filmmaking with a director, one hopes for a steady hand holding the compass. And that is what you get with Chloe Zhao. That's Z-H-A-O. A steady hand and a well-marked roadmap with our film, Nomad Land, and her first, Songs My Brothers Taught Me, and The Rider, the first two of her films, she gained the trust of people offering their intimate life stories. She has an uncanny skill for walking the knife's edge between sentiment and sentimentality, and that enriches her storytelling in very authentic and original ways. It is for all of these reasons that Chloe has the high regard and respect of her peers. At the end of the day, what more could one ask for than that? She's also one of the only people I know who can wear a fleece jacket with puppy faces on it that she bought at an RV swap meet and make it work like it was a Valentino. Lena Khan, K-H-A-N. 31, holding big tech to account, by Elizabeth Warren, Democratic senator from Massachusetts. For too long, giant tech companies have thrown around their weight to crush competition, exploit our data, and spread disinformation. They may think they're too big to be held accountable, but Lena Khan is proving them wrong. Since Lena published her blockbuster Yale Law Journal article, Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, in 2017, written while she was still a law student, I should add, she's been the leading intellectual force in the modern antitrust movement. Her writings and advocacy have pushed scholars, lawyers, activists, and public officials to think differently about big tech. She's also been a critical figure in government, providing advice to countless elected officials, working at the Federal Trade Commission and staffing the House Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Antitrust. Lena's deep knowledge and commitment to discovering the facts on the ground have not only drawn attention to the problem of concentration, but shown how to address it. As Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon face growing scrutiny, we have a huge opportunity to make big structural change by reviving antitrust enforcement and fighting monopolies that threaten our economy, our society, and our democracy. I can't wait to see how Lena will continue to shape that debate. Lena Khan is shown in a photograph standing between two stacks of books and carrying an armful of them. Clementine Jacoby, 29, Decarceration Through Data. And this article is written by Patrick Lucas Austin. More than 2 million people are imprisoned in the U.S., among them hundreds of thousands, who experts say do not pose a public safety threat and could be released. One problem, the data that could trigger those releases get backlogged because they're often spread out among different departments. That's why in 2019, Clementine Jacoby, a software engineer, launched Recidiviz, a nonprofit that's worked with more than 30 states to log into one system key data points, such as whether an incarcerated person has served most of their sentence, or shown progress by completing a treatment program, or more recently, how well-equipped a correction facility is to handle a COVID-19 outbreak. It then uses an algorithm to recommend certain prisoners for release. Our hope is that the people who are succeeding get off early, Jacoby says, and that frees up attention for officers to spend time with the people who actually need it. Of course, no algorithm is perfect, and algorithms alone will not solve the issues of the criminal justice system. But so far, Recidiviz, and that's spelled R-E-C-I-D-I-V-I-Z, has seen early signs of success. To date, the nonprofit has helped identify as appropriate for release nearly 44,000 inmates in 34 states, including North Dakota, which last spring saw its prison population drop by 20%. Clementine Jacoby's last name is spelled J-A-C-O-B-Y. Now, John Jumper, J-U-M-P-E-R, 36, predicting protein shapes. Being able to predict the shape of proteins using amino acid sequences could one day inform the development of new treatments for diseases. But learning the shape of even a single protein costs about $100,000 and takes a full year of a researcher's time. Thanks to John Jumper, lead researcher for UK-based company Deep Minds, AlphaFold, artificial intelligence program, it's now possible to cut that year of work to a single day. AlphaFold leverages neural networks or algorithmic systems that learn by example to more quickly compute the shape a protein folds into. The result? A technological leap forward that demonstrates the power of AI to solve complex problems and a better ability to use proteins to understand how diseases work, develop new drugs, and more. Jeffrey Kluger wrote that column. Rohan Pavaluri, P-A-V-U-L-U-R-I, 25, demystifying bankruptcy. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to put Americans in financial distress, more and more people have lost jobs, incurred expensive medical bills, and faced other hardships. Filing for personal bankruptcy can be an effective way to eliminate debt and re-enter the economy. But high legal fees and complex paperwork can make it difficult to seek that relief, especially for low-income families. That's why in 2018, 25-year-old Rohan Pavaluri founded Upsolve, a nonprofit that offers a free online tool to help users fill out bankruptcy forms on their own. To date, Upsolve has helped U.S. users relieve more than $300 million in debt. We have found a way to use technology to address a civil rights injustice at scale, Pavaluri says. That column was written by Mariah Espada. Apoorva Mehta, 34, and that last name is spelled M-E-H-T-A, Rethinking Home Delivery. This article is written by Alejandro de la Garza. In the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, Instacart faced a tidal wave of orders as people with means opted en masse to pay the service's workers to buy groceries for them. Apoorva Mehta, the company's 34-year-old founder and CEO, calls that period a wartime moment. We just didn't have enough shoppers. Instacart went on a hiring binge in March 2020, bringing on 300,000 gig workers in a matter of weeks. The next month, it announced it would hire 250,000 more. But as usage soared, Instacart faced new criticism about the way it treated its workers, including labyrinthine sick pay policies, frequent rule changes for shoppers, and demanding performance metrics. And after pouring more than $20 million into a controversial ballot initiative in California, Instacart, alongside other firms such as Uber and Lyft, decisively won that bid last fall to avoid classifying their workers as employees under state law. Mehta says this is going to be a conversation that we are going to have as a society over the next decade or so about the gig economy. The ecosystem that we want to build is one that recognizes that flexibility is going to be an important part of people's work. In the meantime, Instacart, which raised more than $500 million in venture capital funding last year, continues to expand. The smartphone is the supermarket of the future, Mehta says. We are going to help co-create that. Adam Kinzinger, K-I-N-Z-I-N-G-E-R, 42, Taking a Stand, by Larry Hogan, who is a Republican and governor of Maryland. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Over the past few months, Congressman Adam Kinzinger has stood up for the truth when it was most challenging and least convenient. In the wake of the insurrection at the Capitol in January, Adam was the first Republican member of Congress to step forward and call for the removal of President Trump from office via the 25th Amendment. In standing up for what he believed was right, Adam proved the measure of his courage. After serving two tours of duty in Iraq, Adam knows what it really means to sacrifice for your country. He understands that the willingness to do so is the minimum requirement of leadership. No job or title is worth more than your integrity. Through his example, Adam's paving the way for others to follow their conscience. I believe he has a bright future ahead, but more important, he will be remembered well by history. Guillermo Bulos, B-O-U-L-O-S, 38, Sao Paulo's Rising Star. This column was written by Ciara Nugent. 2 years into Jair Bolsonaro's controversial presidency, Brazil's fragmented left has mostly struggled to unify behind a leader to challenge the far right. Guillermo Bulos has begun to change that, bolstered by a November run for mayor of Sao Paulo. Born and raised in the city, the largest in South America, Bulos has worked for 2 decades as a community organizer in poor neighborhoods. A month before the first round of voting, he was polling in fourth place as a minority party candidate, with just 10% of the expected vote. But by winning over young people and energizing voters disillusioned with the mainstream left Workers' Party, Bulos beat out Bolsonaro's preferred candidate and others to make it to the second round. In the end, he lost the election, winning 40.6% of the vote to the center-right incumbent's 59.4%. But analysts say his shock performance in the influential city established him as an ascendant figure in Brazilian politics and gave the left a new path forward. Many expect Bulos to run for president in 2022 and to play a major role in rebuilding the left's strength in the meantime. This is not something that ended with the election, Bulos told a Brazilian newspaper after his loss. Our campaign is the start of a new cycle. 3 very short items called short reads, carrying the burden. People who make arguments that canceling student debt would miss those the pandemic touched do not understand the breadth of either the student debt crisis or the current economic crisis, write Suzanne Kahn and Anna N. Smith of the Roosevelt Institute. Among those affected, those under 30, women, and Black and Latinx people. Past as prologue, QAnon conspiracy theories seem familiar to Roland Betancourt, author of Byzantine Intersectionality. The way they manage to straddle the dichotomy between presumable fact and blatant fiction reminds us of important lessons from the medieval past, he writes. Borrowing power. U.S. cities are highly constrained in how much debt they can take on, but Zachary Carabel, author of the forthcoming book Inside Money, says that presents a challenge for economic recovery. Past precedent is important and instructive, but it should not be a straitjacket. From The View, and you will hear only a few lines on this because of time constraints, by Simran Jeet Singh, India on the Precipice. For decades, the world has turned a blind eye to India's abysmal human rights record. This approach draws from a broad Western perception of India as a strategic ally. The U.S., like many other countries, sees India as an important counterweight to China. They are the two most populous nations with mega economies. Global powers tend to prefer India because of its standing as the world's largest democracy. At the same time, India's adversarial relationship with neighboring Pakistan, as well as its increasingly anti-Muslim policies, positions it as a bulwark against so-called Islamic terrorism. Over the past few years, however, the rise of right-wing authoritarianism has brought India's democratic standing into question. India's plummeted in democracy metrics across the board, including the World Press Freedom Index, where it now ranks 142 out of 180 countries, four spots behind South Sudan and three behind Myanmar. The Human Freedom Index ranks India at 111 out of 162 countries, just four ahead of Russia. This is not India's fight, just India's fight, in a world grappling with rising authoritarianism, propaganda, human rights abuses, and anti-democratic practices. Squashing right-wing nationalism is in everyone's best interest. Letting it go unchecked, especially in the world's largest democracy, puts us all at risk. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.